In recent times, Ulysses S. Grant has been dismissed by some as a failed president and person. That was not the case in the 19th century, and our guest thinks it's time to rethink our impression of Grant. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us. Our guest today is Ronald C. White. He is the author of three best-selling books on Abraham Lincoln. He's a fellow at the Huntington Library and a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum of Washington, D.C. His new book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. He says Grant's reputation was incorrectly rewritten, and he wants to set the record straight. What about your opinion or impression of Grant? I hope you'll join in our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 and send an email to talk@wpr.org, or you can also post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Ronald White, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Larry, and your listeners. Thank you.
Great to have you here on this election day. Why did you think it was time for a new biography of Ulysses S. Grant? And kind of what was your inspiration?
Well, my inspiration was the way people once upon a time viewed him. Theodore Roosevelt, in the year 1900, said, "Mightiest of the mighty dead are the three great American leaders, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant." But he went on to say, of second rank are Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, and Andrew Jackson. Well, that took me by surprise, so I had to find out, what did he mean by that? How was Grant viewed, and how did Grant fall from favor?
Yeah, and you really, I've read other books on Grant, and yours takes, a bit of a different tact, and I really enjoyed reading it, as a matter of fact. Talk about that a little bit, because for one thing, you bring Julia, his wife, into a more prominent role.
Well, I've been the beneficiary of the fact that the Grant Papers, which began to be published in 1962, will finally be completed in 2017. So I've had the benefit of looking at all 33 volumes. And the gold of these papers really are Julia and the letters that he wrote to her. She saved every one of them. I felt that Julia had been kind of marginalized in the story. She was a remarkable person. They had a tremendous marriage. She was a partner to him. I wanted to bring her more into focus.
What in your mind is the biggest misconception about Grant?
Well, the biggest misconception is his failed presidency. And without in any way minimizing the scandals that took place in the second term, let's remember he was the only president to be elected to two consecutive terms between Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson. These scandals have obscured what he did in both terms, and I wanted to bring to the forefront, what did he accomplish in these 8 years? I think it's quite a bit.
Yeah, I certainly would agree. And he was for one thing, he was not a heavy drinker, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he was involved in drinking, but again, the stereotype, or rather the caricature, is that he was either a drunkard or an alcoholic. I discovered that he drank more early in his career when he was separated from Julia. He was posted out to the Pacific Coast for 2 years. He fell into loneliness and despair and drinking, and ultimately resigned his commission so he could return to Julia and their children.
And took a job with her dad, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yes, and here's the kind of another. The biography is so filled with irony and paradox. These two young lovers didn't quite realize, like I guess a lot of young lovers, that they were marrying into an extended family. Well, his family was defiantly anti-slavery. Her father owned 30 slaves. So when he came back from the Pacific Coast, he really had to live in the shadow of her father, his father-in-law. And this was a difficult experience, but over time, he won over her father, and that's quite a fascinating family story.
You talk about his love of literature. Where did that love come from?
Well, this, again, is a way I wanted to reshape Grant. Grant has been viewed, yes, he's a man of action, yes, he's the Civil War general, but maybe he's kind of an intellectual lightweight. He did finish only 21st out of 39 in his class at West Point, but in his memoirs, he says about that, "I must apologize." And I wondered, well, why is he apologizing? He said, "I must apologize. I spent most of my time reading novels." Well, I went and spent a week at West Point early in my research for this book, and I said, well, what's going on here? Well, novels were viewed as kind of trashy in that particular era. The West Point Library, which was revolving around engineering and science, really didn't have any novels. So only the boys in their only kind of lending library. Grant then tells us the authors that he read, and in fact, for one author, that he read all 11 of his novels. Well, I think we know that great writers, Grant will write his memoirs at the end of his life, are invariably great readers, but we've missed the story of what did he read.
And I wonder how the things that he read at that time may have had any impact on him as general and later as president.
Well, yes, we can't be specific while he read this page or this chapter, but these books have some common core to them, if you will. They were the story of young men, sometimes in conflict with their fathers, as he was, often involved in military exploits, and so these set for him out what it meant to be a leader. And those books, unlike today, and one reason we don't read them today, was they were very didactic. By that I mean the author would say things like, young reader, you should. And so here's Grant, this boy who's 5 feet tall, 117 pounds, 17 years old, from the West, shy. I'm suggesting that these books became his virtual tutors or professors, tutoring him in what it meant to grow up into manhood, to become a leader.
How did he meet Julia, by the way?
Well, Grant's roommate in his senior year was Frederick Dent from St. Louis, and when Grant was posted to Jefferson Barracks right outside St. Louis, the largest barracks, because this is where people were equipping people to go west, Frederick said, well, you need to visit my parents. They're very hospitable to soldiers. So he did, and there he met Fred's sister, Julia. And it was kind of almost love at first sight, it became a remarkable relationship. The father, again, her father, tried to put off this marriage. He didn't want his daughter marrying a vagabond soldier. They had to wait until the end of the Mexican War, but then he married Julia in 1848. And again, the irony of biography, the three young men who stood up with Grant all would serve in the Confederate Army.
Yeah, what a story that was. And she was, she had an affliction with her eye.
She did. She did. So although we don't have any photographs of her until she's an older, rather more matronly woman, because she was afflicted with what's called strabismus, we would simply call it cross-eyed, and she did not want photographs taken. I don't think she was physically a beautiful person, but she was beautiful in the ways that count. She was vivacious. She was humorous. She was just a lively person that was very attractive to the young men of that era and attractive to Grant.
Yeah, and as you say, kind of love at first sight. And she had great influence on him throughout his life.
Oh, my goodness, yes. He makes this sentiment while he's away on his way to the war with Mexico, where he says to the effect that, Julia, whatever is your will governs my life. I want to do what you want me to do. So she had a tremendous influence on who he was in all the sort of storms of his life. She was that kind of calm, nurturing center, and that's why I want to give her more of a place in my biography.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, at some point in the book, well, I guess when he became, when he was to become president, she wondered if she was good enough for him to be a good enough spouse for him to be president. And he had a nice statement back.
Well, she did. In fact, she considered having surgery on her eyes because she said, in effect, you know, well, I'm not really good enough to be, you're now a great man. And he said, well, goodness sakes, you know, I loved you as you were. I love you as you are. Don't even think of having this surgery. And in fact, she became a tremendous social hostess at the White House. She was a much more outgoing person than he was. And so they complimented each other very much. And her role in the White House was huge.
Grant served in the Mexican-American War, and talk about how his experiences in that conflict affected his service in the Civil War.
Well, he entered that war serving under both Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott. He watched both of these men as leaders, decided he would rather follow Taylor because he was more not so pretentious, not so pompous, just sort of an ordinary man who could get along with his troops. He was asked to serve as quartermaster. He didn't really want to do that. He wanted to be more in the action. But actually, in retrospect, being quartermaster taught him the importance of supplying a huge army, which would come into play in attempting to supply this huge Civil War army.
And it was, and when we're talking about it, it's hard to remember or to think about the number of soldiers that he had control over and the time, you know, supplying the food and everything else that they needed for not just a few guys here.
Yes, the largest American army up until the Civil War was 14,000 that Winfield Scott commanded in the war with Mexico. Well, now Grant is commanding hundreds of thousands of troops. And so those who might have been voted most likely to succeed at West Point didn't succeed when they were faced with this huge gargantuan task. And one of Grant's gifts as a military commander, I did an event this past week with General David Petraeus, and he made the point to our audience that Grant is the greatest American general. And one reason he believes he is because he had the ability to coordinate all these different armies together. He could both be a tactical commander in a battle himself. He could coordinate, and then he could see the strategic, total, large picture. And this is why Grant, I think, deserves the place that I want to give him.
Yeah, for sure. And he was, I think, a master at judging people, his leaders, the guys that were just right under him and leading the various groups to battle. He was really good at that.
Here's the paradox, of course, is that, yes, he was. In the Civil War, he could judge who was good and not. William Rosecrans was probably, if they had a vote, would have been voted most likely to succeed in his class at West Point. But Grant saw that, no, he wasn't really a good commander. The irony, of course, is that somehow he lost some of that capacity when he became president, the ability to judge the character of those around him.
Ray in Rhinelander has something for us. Hi, Ray. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
This is a good show again. Thank you, Larry, and thank the person who's presenting things. Did you, by chance, look into the psychopersonality of Grant, what he went through during the mid part of the Civil War, like the Battle of Vicksburg? There's a lot of mistakes making, and a considerable loss of men. Besides that part of the war, just the war in general, what was his reaction to the losses and the different events and things and the decisions he made? So far, you've covered a lot of really good things, but there's that aspect that was that researched more? We have this generalization, we have some facts, but what do you have on that? And I'll take it off.
Well, thank you for your question. It's a very important question because down through the years, for many, many years, the common perception was that Grant sort of threw his soldiers heedlessly into battle and suffered huge casualties, and that he suffered, therefore, in comparison to General Robert E. Lee. Now Civil War historians would say, no, it's exactly the opposite, that Grant's casualties were less than Lee. What I discovered as Grant was growing up as a boy on the frontier of Ohio was that he didn't like to use the use of guns. All these boys would use guns naturally for hunting. He would not hunt. And so Grant was really did not like death, just frightened him. And so he did not want to throw his soldiers into this. Oh, there were episodes. He had to apologize for Cold Harbor, where he lost 7,000 men in 20 minutes. But Grant was very careful and learned from his mistakes. His very first battle at Belmont in southern Missouri on the Mississippi River, they won seemingly a battle, and without looking carefully, suddenly the Confederates came to reinforce the troops that they thought had been defeated. So a big question in military strategy is, does a person learn from their mistakes?
And I want to have you continue that conversation, Ron White. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Many people are under the impression that Ulysses S. Grant won the Civil War through brute force and was a failed president. Our guest today certainly disagrees with that. I'm Larry Mueller again. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network with our guest, Ronald C. White. He is the author of three best-selling books on Abraham Lincoln, fellow at the Huntington Library, senior fellow at of the Trinity Forum of Washington, D.C. His latest book, fascinating one. It's titled American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. What are your impressions of Grant? How does he rank as a president? I hope you'll join in our conversation by calling at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Ronald White, as we broke for news, you were talking about Grant learning from his mistakes on the battlefield.
Yes, I referenced the first battle he fought at Belmont on the Mississippi River, and then at Shiloh. There's no question that he was surprised at Shiloh in April of 1862 by Confederate forces under Albert Sidney Johnson. That evening after the first day when his troops were almost pushed back into the Tennessee River, William Tecumseh Sherman, his closest military friend, found Grant standing in the rain underneath a tree. Grant had tried to be in the hospital, but he couldn't stand the amputations. Yeah. And so Sherman came up to him and said, "Wow, we really took a licking today." And Grant simply replied, "We'll lick them tomorrow." And so he did. And he regrouped his forces and drove the Confederates from the battlefield at Shiloh.
And he was the kind of leader you really wanted to have, I think, in those kind of circumstances. He was not a guy that got totally upset and kind of lost his mind at any time. He was calm, cool, and collected, I think.
Well, this is what I learned from General Petraeus, who I was with this week. He compared Grant to Eisenhower, MacArthur, other great generals, and he pointed out that his calm, his determination, this is absolutely critical in terms of leading a force into battle. And General Petraeus said that as he prepared to lead the surge in Iraq, he both read Grant and extolled Grant to the men under him, that this is one of the key characteristics that has made Grant such a great general.
We have callers online with questions for you, so let's go to Jimmy in Maguanago next. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I was just wondering, after the Civil War was over, and I have to give you credit, you have exposed Gentleman Grant for what he really was as an individual, other than a general and a president and everything else, the man he was. I think you've done a great job of representing him. And I, being from Virginia, I have the same respect for General Robert E. Lee, and I'm just wondering, after the war, did they ever have an opportunity to sit down as gentlemen and discuss the war and discuss, our great leader Robert E. Lee just said, go home and be Americans. I just wonder, was there ever any intimate discussions between Lee and Grant?
Well, thank you for bringing General Lee into the conversation. This is an important part of the story. When the war was over and President Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson wanted to prosecute Lee and the other leading Confederate generals. And General Grant stood up and said, absolutely not. He said, I've made an agreement with General Lee. General Lee has abided by that agreement. And what I've learned, he said, is that General Lee is in many ways the spiritual leader of the South. The South will do what he wants them to do. And you will not prosecute for treason General Robert E. Lee. They did have one meeting in Washington. Lee only lived until 1868. We don't really know the content of that meeting, but they did have one conversation. Lee was extremely grateful to Grant for his advocacy that he would become a free man. Lee became the president of Washington and then what became Washington and Lee College.
Yep.
Indeed. And I owned a restaurant right across the street from Washington and Lee and just down the road from BMI University. And I I was exposed to some of the depth of the gentleman himself. And I have to say, as a man from the South, deep down in our hearts, we do respect and love Grant for what he did for our country.
Well, and just a one quick comment there, for Grant also earned the nickname the Hero of Appomattox, and he was the Hero of Appomattox because of the magnanimous peace treaty that he offered to Lee in the South. So many in the South they didn't have a great admiration for Sherman, but they had a great admiration for Grant.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jimmy, for calling. I want to go to Jim in Rice Lake, who has a question that I think relates to this. Jim, hi, thanks for calling.
I have three quick comments. One is that Grant's intellect is underrated, that of all of the American presidents, his is considered the seminally best memoir of any of our presidents. The second point is that he's an underrated president because he, more than any other, because of the Teapot Dome scandal, but he, more than any of our post-Civil War presidents, were serious about African-Americans, then called Negroes, having real serious rights and liberties within the reconstituted United States. In fact, it was presidents after him that imposed Jim Crow. And finally, that Robert E. Lee is excessively overrated militarily. In fact, all of his victories were essentially defensive in nature. His one offensive campaign, which was Gettysburg, led to disaster, in contrast to Grant's outstanding strategic as well as tactical military brilliance. I'll take our guest comments off the air.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Jim.
Well, Jim, I can only say yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And in this particular time in the last couple of years when we've been dealing with what we are calling voter suppression, where many states have been putting in regulations that seem clearly often aimed at diminishing the vote of African Americans, and in some states, Latinos, Grant, I think perhaps his greatest claim to fame as president was he stepped up and decided he would defend the right of African Americans to vote. We forget that he was elected in 1868 with a non-white majority. He won that popular vote only because 400,000 African Americans voted for him. And as his own Republican Party began to retreat from Reconstruction, retreat from the 14th and 15th Amendments, he stood squarely for African Americans and against the Ku Klux Klan and the other white leaguers, which were often in league with the Democratic Party, because they understood that if African Americans voted in the South, they would vote for Republicans.
Very interesting. And his demeanor and his work with Indians, I think, has been overlooked. And I was really glad to read that chapter in your book.
Well, yes, this was a surprise to me also. In his first inaugural address, 1869, he says very clearly, we have treated the Indians in this country in an immoral way, and we have to rethink this policy. What was his goal? Well, he wanted to bring civilization. You could accuse him and others of the period that somewhat this meant assimilation. But more importantly, they needed to be citizens. And so who would be the first director of the Indian Affairs Bureau?
Yeah.
His aide, Eliza Parker, who was a full-blooded Indian. He asked his attorney general, is it possible for an Indian who is not a citizen to be the head of my Indian Bureau? And fortunately, the attorney general said, yes, he is. So here's another overlooked aspect of Grant's leadership as president.
Let's turn to Ted in Ashland next. Ted, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi, thank you. I read Grant's memoirs last year because I heard for a long time that they were one of the best examples of such memoirs, and I have to say I wasn't disappointed at all. One thing that struck me, and I'm sure Mr. White will be able to speak about this, is that when Grant's a young officer in the Mexican War, and they're closing in on Mexico City, and there's a lot of serious fighting and casualties and so forth, that in his memoir, he makes a political observation, obviously written well after the fact, that in his opinion, that war was drummed up on somewhat of a pretext, and he considered it more or less of a land grab, and that he didn't really agree with that from that point of view, but that as a soldier he was going to go ahead and do his duty, which he did. And I wonder if you, in the context of all the current acrimony and debate about immigration and so forth and so on, would you speak about that? It was phenomenal that the hero of the Civil War, two-term president, once described the takeover of, correct me if I'm wrong, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, various other parts of the Southwest is a land grab. And
yeah,
and,
let's get a comment. Ronald White?
Yes, well, thank you, Ted. You're posing a very important question. I make the point that when Grant enters the war with Mexico, crosses the Rio Grande, that he's really crossing several boundaries, certainly the physical boundary into Mexico, but that many of his fellow soldiers never really entered into the Mexican culture, were really pretty depreciating in their understanding of the Mexican people. Not so Grant. He set about to learn Spanish. He had a great appreciation for Mexico and its culture. He wrote home to Julia that Monterrey was probably the most beautiful city he'd ever encountered. And this started a whole love affair with Mexico that lasted throughout his entire life. So even more than the land grab aspect, I would say he thought that this was an immoral war, because here was a large nation with a large army kind of attacking a much smaller nation with an army not at all prepared to fight. And so he actually had some of those sentiments while he was a soldier. But yes, you're right. He looks back on this through the lens of history, the lens of the Civil War, and says this is certainly the most immoral war our nation has ever fought.
Yeah, absolutely. Ted, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And we'll turn to Greg in Madison next. Greg, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I would like for your guest to talk about the later years of President Grant's life, how he basically was broke or was going broke, and the writing of his memoir saved him from going broke, and how that kind of correlates to his earlier years when he basically couldn't make a go of anything. And he entered the Civil War and of course, gained fame and success there. So I would love for your guest to comment on that. I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg, very much. That's an important question and comment. Grant lost his money at the end of his life, not through his own efforts, but his son, Buck, the second son, was involved with a partner in a Wall Street investment company, and neither the son or the father realized that the partner was a crook. He was involved in a Ponzi scheme. He would ultimately go to jail for 8 years. And so in a single day, Grant walked home to Julia with $81 in his pocket. He had lost everything. Remember, this is the era before, long before presidential pensions. They wouldn't come till the time of Harry S. Truman. And so the proposal came that he would write his memoir. Well, he didn't want to write his memoir because he thought memoirs were, I think we've seen this recently, are often very self-serving, settling scores, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. He was even critical of Sherman's memoirs, which had some of that spirit. But now he has no money, and then he is diagnosed with throat cancer, actually cancer of the base of the tongue. How is he going to support Julia? He's in a life and death race against time. So he does accept the opportunity to write his memoirs. They will be published by Mark Twain, who recognizes even more than Grant does that Grant is a great writer. And so what I call his final campaign is this heroic story to write these memoirs. He finishes them 3 days before his death in 1885. They would earn $450,000 for Julia in 19th century money.
That was an amazing story. And it's like you wonder if he was just keeping himself alive to finish that memoir.
I think you're right. The doctors believe that he only was kept alive because he needed to finish the memoirs.
When his we talked a bit about his presidency, and his selections, I think the first time round, he picked a lot of his friends or people that he knew and trusted well and thought they had the right abilities, and he picked some pretty good people the first time round.
He did. It was a mixed story. Yes, he picked people of friends, influence, not always qualified. Perhaps the finest pick he made was Hamilton Fish, who had already retired in New York, chairman of the board of then Columbia College. And Fish said, all right, well, I'll come and I'll serve for a month or two. Fish ended up serving for 8 years. And Grant, from Fish's point of view, became a quick study in learning about foreign affairs. Sadly, most American presidents have not come to office without any experience. But Fish and Grant put together a treaty with England. The nation was very angry at England because it was in England that these Confederate raiding ships were built, who sunk not only Union Navy but commercial ships. But this treaty with England set in motion the foundation for successive treaties that would become the basis of an alliance, our strongest alliance, and also showed the possibility of international arbitration as opposed to war as a way to settle differences.
And as I think you write in the book, after his second term was over, he went on quite a world tour. And was
he
in England
he
and saw
he
those.
He loved to travel, and he was just going to do this as a private citizen with Julia and their youngest son. He arrives in Liverpool and is greeted by thousands and thousands of people. He's a hero. He represents the best of America. And what they liked about him was he wasn't arrogant. He didn't have medals on his chest. He wasn't the big me personality. Yes, they had them back then, too. Charles Sumner was one of those people. He was a kind of a common, ordinary, garden variety person who got on well with common people, and they fell in love with him all across Europe and finally all the way to China and Japan.
Yeah, and I think you write about him actually visiting the wharf where those ships were.
He visited the wharfs where the Confederate raiding ships had been built and launched, yes.
You wonder what he thought, what was going through his mind as he was looking.
right.
But he was pretty, I mean, I'm trying to think of another president after the fact, maybe Jimmy Carter, who was so taken and was so respected, and his way of dealing with people's heads of states in other countries was really something great.
Well, that's a good point to bring in Jimmy Carter in this sense that when we do biographies, we often focus almost so solely on a person's presidency. But what we really see here in Grant was his post-presidency, not first his trip around the world, which is 2.5 years, and then his memoirs at the end of his life. They deserve to be part of why we would appreciate him as a great American leader.
We have a question from Alan, just going back a little bit. He emailed to say that the Vicksburg campaign was perhaps Grant's greatest triumph. He and Sherman inverted modern war. They moved like lightning, lived off the land, and cut the Confederacy in half.
I would agree. I think, and even today, I think modern, at least up till recently, that Vicksburg has been kind of a tract or a test case as to how to fight a battle. It was a deeply fortified town defending the Mississippi River. Grant understood that if they could capture that town and therefore divide the Confederacy, he had a variety of attempts that didn't work. And then he finally went south of Vicksburg, crossed the Mississippi, and instead of going directly to Vicksburg northwest, he went northeast, and he won 5 separate battles. By the time he got to Vicksburg, the force had been weakened. He did have to mount a siege, And his victory there, I think, deserves all the credit that military historians give it.
Yeah. And, of course, Lincoln was a big fan of Grant's, and Grant was a big fan of Lincoln's.
They were. This remarkable relationship, you know, Lincoln had to endure a lot of failed generals. And after the Battle of Vicksburg, I love it, Lincoln wrote a letter to Grant and says, "Dear sir, I don't believe we've ever had the privilege of meeting. I simply wish to say when you decided to do that, I thought that was a mistake. I thought that was wrong because he did an unusual battle plan. When you did that, I wasn't sure that was correct." And then Lincoln ends his letter by saying, "I simply wish to say I was wrong and you were right."
Yeah.
What a remarkable letter.
Well, in a remarkable exchange, there was talk of Grant running against Lincoln.
Yes.
And
Lincoln was a little concerned because Grant was a very, very popular, and so he sought out someone who would know Grant. And when the man got to the White House, he said, "Well, let me read you a letter from Grant that just came to me," in which Grant says, "I have no interest in politics, and obviously my interest is in supporting Lincoln and his reelection." And so Lincoln was very assured by that letter.
Lincoln at one point was almost shot himself at one of the later battles.
He did. Jubal Early came the closest, leading a Confederate attack upon Washington, and Lincoln went out to see what was going on, and his tall figure with that tall hat, and supposedly Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. yelled to him, "Get down!" Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. yelled to him, "Get down, you damn fool!" He was almost shot. Yeah.
Amazing man. And so just here in the last 30 seconds or so, overall, your impressions of Grant as president?
Well, it's interesting that it is in this particular election season, but even in just modern politics, to use a sports metaphor, I would say that Grant let the leadership come to him. He was very much against ambition in military. The office came to him. The same with the presidency. He told Sherman, he said, "I didn't want this office. I didn't seek this office, but I had to step in after the failed presidency of Andrew Johnson." So his humility, his self-effacement, his willingness to give the credit to others, which he always did, is why I think we need to look at him afresh. I think he's kind of a model for what American leadership can and should be.
And you've done a fine job of that. Thank you so much for your book, and thank you for your time today, Ronald White.
Larry, thank you very much. A privilege to be with you.
Ronald White is the author of American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Really enjoyed that book. And as always, we have more shows coming up, and we'll be talking tomorrow at this time about a new research tool that's being used to testing the water in the Mississippi River. In the meantime, we have lots in store. Please stay with us here on the Ideas Network.